Today is Monday, April 12th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Iran calls a blackout at its Natanz atomic facility an act of nuclear terrorism.
The underground Natanz facility houses centrifuges used to enrich uranium. Tehran had just announced the testing of its latest IR-9 centrifuge, which it says will enrich uranium 50 times faster than its first generation.
Plus, Greece has lashed out at Turkey for alleging that the government in Athens is aiding and abetting Kurdish terrorists. We'll have these stories and more next. Iran is calling a blackout at its Natanz atomic facility an act of nuclear terrorism. AP correspondent Ben Thomas is up first.
The head of Iran's civilian nuclear program told state television the blackout was caused by sabotage. The underground Natanz facility houses centrifuges used to enrich uranium. Tehran had just announced the testing of its latest IR-9 centrifuge, which it says will enrich uranium 50 times faster than its first generation. Suspicion as to responsibility for the blackout fell immediately on Israel. Israeli media has reported a cyber attack orchestrated by Israel was the cause. Sunday night, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu toasted his security chiefs, the head of the Mossad intelligence agency, at his side. He spoke of the fight against Iran and its nuclear program and said Israel has transformed itself from helplessness into a world power. I'm Ben Thomas.
Despite warnings that no quick breakthroughs were expected, both U.S. and Iranian officials were praising last week's indirect talks in Vienna that were aimed at reviving the 2015 international Iran nuclear deal. The U.S. and Iran have agreed to a second round of indirect talks in Vienna this week to try to bring each other back into compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal, but Iran has insisted that all U.S. sanctions be lifted, and the U.S. has warned that such a demand may lead to an impasse. VOA's Cindy Sain takes it from here.
In Vienna, U.S. and Iranian officials stayed in separate hotels, and the two sides met separately with the other signatories of the 2015 agreement on Iran's nuclear program. Great Britain, France, Germany, Russia, and China. Both Washington and Tehran described the discussion as constructive. They are the first indirect talks between the United States and Iran since Washington withdrew from the agreement in 2018 under then-President Donald Trump. U.S. State Department spokesman Ned Price said there is no expectation of direct negotiations for now, but that the United States is open to them. When asked about the first major obstacle that each side wants the other side to move first, Price cited the deployment of U.S. Special Envoy Rob Malley and other top officials to Vienna to work things out diplomatically. He stressed the need for compromise.
It leaves us where we started, really, with the knowledge that maximalist demands probably are not going to get us very far.
The talks are getting a lot of attention in Iran, where citizens are cautious in public, but likely hoping for economic relief from crippling Western sanctions. Diplomats in Vienna have established two working groups, one to work on how Iran can return to compliance on its nuclear program, and the other on which sanctions the U.S. can ease. The Atlantic Council's Barbara Slavin says she thinks President Joe Biden can get the nuclear deal revived.
The Democrats control both houses of Congress, and Donald Trump actually may have done us a favor, because by pulling out of the deal unilaterally while Iran was in compliance with it, he actually made the deal more popular.
The University of Vienna's Heinz Gadner says a 25-year, $400 billion strategic cooperation pact reached between Iran and China late last month may have provided more incentive for all sides to get the Iran nuclear deal back up and running.
With China, we have this interesting phenomena that China and Iran agreed to this comprehensive accord now, economic and even cultural. And indirectly, that was a pressure what the Americans felt as well.
During a cabinet meeting Wednesday, Iranian President Hassan Rouhani said the talks represent a fresh chapter and that all parties involved recognize that the agreement, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, is the only way forward. Some experts see a window of opportunity to revive the nuclear deal before Iran holds presidential elections on June 18th. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
Greece has lashed out at Turkey for alleging that the government in Athens is aiding and abetting Kurdish terrorists, but the accusations that are contained in a newly released video comes after reports in Greece that Turkey has granted citizenship to Islamic State militants. Anthony Karasava reports the fresh accusations traded by the two NATO allies may threaten ongoing negotiations to ease long-standing differences that nearly sparked a war between them last year.
It is not the first time Turkey has made such accusations against Greece.
One country that stands out as a haven for the PKK and FETÖ is our neighbor and NATO ally, Greece.
Yet in rebuffing the claim, calling it mythical and propaganda, the foreign ministry in Athens questioned the timing of the video's release by the chief communications advisor to Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. The video comes days after reports in Greece accused Ankara of granting citizenship to a number of IS militants, a move that raises serious concerns about Turkey's border controls with Syria. The Interior and Finance Ministries have seized the assets of 8 people suspected of having links to the terror group. But the video comes days also before Greek Foreign Minister Nikos Dendias goes to Ankara to meet with his Turkish counterpart Mevlüt Çavuşoğlu to thrash out long-standing differences between the two neighbors. Analyst Manolis Kostidis explains. It won't be an easy round of talks, he says. Kostidis also says the Turkish side will raise several issues, and it's highly unlikely that even if the talks do go well, that Greece can start speaking of improved relations between the age-old foes. Greece and Turkey have been at odds for decades over sea and air rights in the Aegean Sea that divides them. In the past year, relations have deteriorated over oil and gas drilling rights in the eastern Mediterranean, a standoff that nearly brought the two NATO allies to the brink of war. Since then, senior European Union officials and the United States have intervened, bringing the two sides to a negotiating table to sort out differences. Two rounds of exploratory talks have so far made little progress, and the coming discussions between the Greek and Turkish ministers are being seen as an attempt to salvage the process altogether. But with both sides trading accusations anew, analysts like Apostolos Magiriadis say they fear negotiations may be derailed.
Η Αθήνα δεν θέλει να πάρει τον Μουτζούρι αν θέλει αποτυχία σε αυτή την επίσκεψη. Το Ελληνικό Υπουργείο Εξωτερικών.
The feeling among diplomats in Athens, he says, is that there is a concerted attempt by Turkey's deep state to torpedo these talks. Greece, he said, does not want to appear as the side abandoning the process, and it will keep to its pledge of sending its foreign minister to Turkey. Athens has suggested taking bilateral differences to the International Court of Justice in The Hague if negotiations with Ankara fail to make a diplomatic breakthrough. Talks are scheduled to begin Wednesday. Antti Karasava for VOA News, Athens, Greece.
You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Steve Miller. China's top disease control official says the country is formally considering mixing COVID-19 vaccines as a way of further boosting vaccine efficacy. Reuters' Freddie Joyner has the details.
Available data shows Chinese vaccines lag behind others, including Pfizer and Moderna, in terms of efficacy, but require less stringent temperature controls during storage. Gao Fu, the director of the Chinese Centers for Disease Control and Prevention on Saturday, said the current available vaccines, quote, don't have very high rates of protection. Adding, quote, inoculation using vaccines of different technical lines is being considered. Gao said that taking steps to optimize the vaccine process, including changing the number of doses and the length of time between doses, was a definite solution to the efficacy issues. China has developed 4 domestic vaccines approved for public use, and an official said on Saturday that the country will likely produce 3 billion doses by the end of the year. A COVID-19 vaccine developed by China's Sinovac was found to have an efficacy rate of slightly above 50% in Brazilian clinical trials. A separate study in Turkey said it was 83.5% effective. No detailed efficacy data has been released on vaccines made by China's Sinopharm. A World Health Organization panel said in March that both vaccine makers have presented data on their COVID-19 vaccines, indicating levels of efficacy in line with those required by the WHO. China has shipped millions of its vaccines abroad, and officials and state media have fiercely defended the shots while calling into question the safety and logistics capabilities of other vaccines.
Freddie Joyner from Reuters. The World Health Organization is warning that COVID-19 cases and deaths are rising globally, partly because of complacency setting in that vaccines will stop the spread of the disease. The latest WHO report confirms more than 133.5 million cases of coronavirus infections, including nearly 3 million global deaths. Lisa Schlein has that story.
Data show a worrisome uptick in coronavirus cases and deaths in all regions of the world, with Africa slightly less affected than other regions. The World Health Organization attributes this rise to several factors, including an increase in coronavirus variants, failure to practice public health measures, and the resumption of so-called normal life when people emerge from lockdown. Another problem, says WHO spokeswoman Margaret Harris, is a growing complacency that the availability of vaccines will soon end the crisis.
People are misunderstanding that, seeming to think that vaccination will stop transmission. That is not the case. We need to bring down the transmission while giving the vaccination the chance to stop the severe disease and the severe deaths.
WHO reports nearly 670 million doses of vaccines have been administered globally. However, most of those doses have been given in wealthy countries. Furthermore, WHO warns there is a critical shortage of vaccines. Harris says some countries cannot start COVID-19 inoculation campaigns because of the serious shortfall of doses, especially in developing countries.
So what can be done about it? Doubling down on the public health social measures, truly understanding we have to keep on social distancing, we have to avoid indoor crowded settings, we have to keep wearing the masks, even if vaccinated.
The good news, says Harris, is preliminary results from countries such as Britain show that vaccination programs have averted very large numbers of deaths. However, until most of the world is vaccinated, she says people must not let down their guard. They must remain vigilant and practice the few simple public health measures that have been shown to work. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A series of expert witnesses said last week that a white former police officer accused of murdering the death of an African-American man used excessive force in restraining him. Michael Sullivan reports on the second week of the trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin, who was accused of murder and manslaughter in the death of George Floyd.
A lung and critical care specialist was asked about the cause of Floyd's death as police attempted to arrest him. He was accused of trying to use a counterfeit $20 bill.
Yes, Mr. Floyd died from a low level of oxygen, and this caused damage to his brain.
And suffocation, he said, triggered heart failure. Prodded by Chauvin's lawyer, a forensic pathologist said drugs in Floyd's body were a factor in his death, but were not what killed him.
In this case, I believe the primary mechanism of death is asphyxia or low oxygen.
But boosting Chauvin's defense that underlying illnesses contributed to Floyd's death, the medical examiner said hypertensive heart disease and an enlarged heart were factors.
So he has a heart that already needs more oxygen than a normal heart by virtue of its size, and it's limited in its ability to step up to provide more oxygen when there's demand because of the narrowing of his coronary arteries.
The Minneapolis police chief was asked about the level of force that Chauvin used as Floyd was held down on the ground, at one point unresponsive and motionless.
To continue to apply that level of force to a person proned out, handcuffed behind their back, that in no way, shape, or form is anything that is by policy, is not part of our training, and it is certainly not part of our ethics or our values.
Another expert witness said restraining a person by kneeling on his neck was not taught in police training. It could be permitted in some cases, said a Minneapolis police trainer, but only to a point.
Say, for example, the subject was under control and handcuffed, would this be authorized?
I would say no.
Chauvin's lawyer, through his questions, painted a different scene of Floyd as hard to restrain, police as confronted by hostile bystanders, requiring a decisive response from Chauvin. Floyd's death last May 25th triggered an outpouring of grief in Minneapolis and worldwide protests. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News.
Derek Chauvin's trial resumes on Monday. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Southern African governments are debating how to respond to the growing Islamic State-linked insurgency in Mozambique's gas-rich Cabo Delgado province. One major question is, what threat are the insurgents posing to neighboring countries? For analysis, VOA's Jason Patinkin reached out to Ryan Cummings in Cape Town, South Africa. Cummings is the director of Signal Risk, a South Africa-based security analysis and risk management company.
So first of all, Ryan, this insurgency is focused in Cabo Delgado, but what's the threat of it expanding beyond that province in Mozambique or across borders?
Yeah, I think the key issue at the moment is if we look at the violence, it's very much concentrated in the northernmost districts of Cabo Delgado province. But what we've seen over the past, 24 months or so, and specifically the last year, is kind of the southward expansion of the violence. There's been a few attacks closer to the town of Pemba. The other issue probably relates to a northward spread of the insurgency across the Mozambican borders into neighboring Tanzania. We have seen, some accounts of Tanzanian border patrols arresting suspected insurgents. I think there was one exchanged along the Rovuma River on the Tanzanian side of the border, which indicated a potential militant presence, within Tanzanian territory, and also the capabilities of this group to potentially extend the insurgents' operations within Tanzania as well.
And now let's look at South Africa, because there have been reports of South African nationals having joined the insurgents. What do we know about that?
Very little at this stage. I mean, the Hawks agency, which is one of the security agencies in South Africa, they've specifically referenced the fact that South Africans have joined the Al-Suna network in northern Mozambique. Motivations for their decision were not disclosed, but just from assessing the likely motivation for South Africans to join this group may be rooted to Al-Suna's alliance affiliation with the Islamic State. We know in South Africa that the Islamic State ideology has gained resonance among some members of the population. We know that South Africans had traveled to Iraq and Syria to fight for the group. And basically, Al-Sunnah's alignment and acceptance by the Islamic State as one of its affiliates may be the actual factor at this stage, which is drawing South Africans to northern Mozambique to engage in this conflict or insurgency.
Does that mean that South Africa could be at risk of attacks?
There has been direct threats made by the Islamic State against South Africa in relation to this insurgency. In last September, they issued a statement in the Al Naba publication, specifically warning South Africa that if it does intend to militarily involve itself in the insurgency in Cabo Delgado, that it will essentially conduct reprisals within South Africa's borders, stating that this could potentially come from militants across in Mozambique or even potentially from within South Africa itself.
And along those lines, there has been some kind of intervention from South Africa. There's the Dyke Advisory Group, this private military contractor, some call them mercenaries, which has been deployed. The South African military also sent troops to help with evacuations. Could there potentially be blowback against South Africa for these sorts of actions?
At this stage, I think that the engagement specifically of the Dyke Advisory Group has, you know, kind of consistent in Mozambique for several months now, and there hasn't been any kind of, you know, punitive violence in South Africa because of that. I think it's the perception that this is not been endorsed by South Africa. It's kind of a private, you know, military contractor that's not representative of South Africa's foreign policy position on this issue. Also, the current deployment of troops that assisted in evacuation involving South Africans in Cabo Delgado province has also not had an offensive mandate. It was more just to kind of ensure the provision of security as South Africans who were potentially impacted by the violence were being repatriated back to the country. So at this stage, obviously, there was little motivation for militants either based in Mozambique or based in South Africa to target South Africa in, you know, punitive acts of violence, because that in itself could be the potential catalyst for intervention by the South African military in Mozambique. But the key concern is obviously if South Africa does assume a more offensive mandate, deploys our military to Mozambique, directly engages against these militants, that I think will be the issue which could attract potential threats, either external or internal, to our national security.
That was Signal Risk Director Ryan Cummings speaking to my colleague, Jason Patinkin. The European Union's top diplomat said on Sunday that Russia and China were hampering a united international response to Myanmar's military coup, and that the EU could offer more economic incentives if democracy returns to the country. Security forces have killed more than 700 unarmed protesters, including 46 children, since the military seized power on February 1st, according to a tally by the Assistance Association for Political Prisoners. That figure also includes the 82 people who were killed on Friday in the town of Bago. Tributes have been offered from around the world to Prince Philip, the husband of Britain's Queen Elizabeth, who died on Friday at the age of 99. Henry Ridgewell has that story.
On the gates of Buckingham Palace, a simple message was posted Friday morning. It is with deep sorrow that Her Majesty the Queen has announced the death of her beloved husband, His Royal Highness the Prince Philip, Duke of Edinburgh. Within hours, floral tributes began to pile up outside the palace. Among those visiting was London resident Lisa Welsh.
I think it's a huge loss, not only just because he's part of the royal family, but he's a husband, father, you know, he's been there for the Queen through her whole reign. And I think, yeah, the whole nation will be sad.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson addressed the nation from London.
Prince Philip earned the affection of generations here in the United Kingdom, across the Commonwealth, and around the world. He was the longest-serving consort in history, one of the last surviving people in this country to have served in the Second World War.
The first reaction from family members came from Philip's grandson, Prince Harry, and his wife Meghan, who quit royal duties last year. A short message on their website read, "Thank you for your service. You will be greatly missed." U.S. President Joe Biden offered this tribute from the White House Friday.
Joe and I, the entire administration, send our condolences to Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II. On the loss of Prince Philip, he was a heck of a guy. His lifetime of service to the United Kingdom and the whole Commonwealth was visible to everybody for a long, long time. And his bravery serving in World War II, as well as his being a champion of the environment, as well as the charitable things he set up. So we really do express our condolences for an extraordinary life that was led by the prince.
Former U.S. President Barack Obama and his wife Michelle met the Queen and Prince Philip in 2009. In a statement issued Friday, they said Prince Philip in particular was kind and warm, with a sharp wit and unfailing good humor. We will miss him dearly. In Ottawa, Canada, a member of the Commonwealth, the bell on Parliament Hill rang 99 times, one for each year of Prince Philip's life.
Prince
Justin Trudeau, Prime Minister of Canada, gave this televised message.
Prince Philip will be remembered as a champion for young people, a decorated naval officer, a dedicated philanthropist, and a constant in the life of Queen Elizabeth II.
Scott Morrison, the Prime Minister of Australia, wrote on Twitter, "Prince Philip embodied a generation that we will never see again." Residents of Sydney remembered him fondly, among them Tina Holthouse.
He might not have been the king, but he was the king in so many eyes, I think.
India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi tweeted, "He had a distinguished career in the military and was at the forefront of many community service initiatives. May his soul rest in peace." Mumbai resident Hiren Sukhadia offered these thoughts.
"He was a very good gentleman. He has done a very good job for his country also."
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan tweeted, "I convey my deepest condolences on behalf of my country and the Turkish nation." Zimbabwean President Emmerson Mnangagwa offered deepest condolences as tributes continue to pour in from dozens of world leaders. In public, Prince Philip was rarely seen away from the Queen's side. Despite his supporting role, he invariably left a deep impression on those he met. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
And finally, Cambodia Burning, a documentary by filmmaker Sean Gallagher, throws light on the effect Cambodia's unfettered logging has been on the country's forest ecosystem. VOA's Penelope Pulu spoke to the award-winning filmmaker.
In Cambodia Burning, filmmaker Sean Gallagher combined drone footage of destroyed forests with poetry, hoping to evoke a visceral feeling. He told VOA he collaborated with Cambodian poets he kept anonymous for their protection from Cambodia's repressive regime.
"I said, please speak from your heart about how this makes you feel. I'm not interested in statistics or numbers about fires or deforestation. I want to know what this means to Cambodian people."
Gallagher says a NASA publication showing massive forest fires dotting the country inspired him to go there and film in remote areas.
"And they were reporting how the forest fires taking place in Cambodia were actually visible from space. And Cambodia, they reported, had more forest fires than any other country in Southeast Asia during the dry season from January to March. That also inspired me to look into this story, because obviously as a photographer and filmmaker, I'm always thinking of the visual elements to a story and how impactful they could be."
Gallagher says the two main threats to the forests of Cambodia are the clearance of forests for plantation farming and timber poaching, especially of high-value timber like rosewood, exported across Asia and around the world. The Cambodia fires are fueled by deforestation, a drop in rainfall, and a rise in dry conditions, says Michaela Wise, project manager with Global Forest Watch at the World Resources Institute, a Washington-based think tank.
"In 2020, Cambodia lost primary forests at a rate of 10 soccer fields per hour, with a total of 62,000 hectares lost in just 1 year."
Weiss says cutting down forests has major implications for global warming, as trees absorb about a third of the world's carbon emissions and are an essential habitat for wildlife. She says forests are under threat there, especially during and after the pandemic.
"We've heard stories of people returning to rural areas after they've lost their jobs and clearing more forests as a result."
Sean Gallagher says the future of Cambodia's forests remains bleak. He says free speech is very limited in Cambodia and there is lack of transparency on forest logging there.
"Because the plantations are connected to big business in Cambodia, which are connected to the government."
Gallagher hopes his film will draw global attention and help put international pressure on Cambodia's government. He also hopes to shed light on the work local conservationists and activists are doing there. "They are the last lines of defense for Cambodia's forests," he says, determined to protect what's left. Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by visiting our website. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.